This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest portion of the show, the strange tale of Mitt Romney and the 47%. The secret recording tests the Republican nominee.
47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes doesn't connect.
Also, will the Supreme Court finally take up same-sex marriage? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, The End of Men, a new book about why I might soon have to give up this microphone. Also, enjoy that big gulp. It might be your last. New York City tries to curb our addiction to soda. And finally, Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie, The Master.
When you sleep, do you have nightmares?
Not as much as before.
You've had violent episodes.
Yes, sir, we all did.
Our show begins with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Joining me today are John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent and political director of CBS News. Hello, John.
Hello, darling.
Did you say darling? That was so cute.
And joining me in New Haven is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. That is so cute, Emily. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
So it's a very bizarre week in politics, which we will honor with a glorious variety of topics, wildly different, all enthralling. First, of course, the Mitt Romney 47% controversy. What happened? What's at stake? Does it matter? Second, the Supreme Court and gay marriage. Will the court rule on the most gripping social issue of our time? Plus, of course, cocktail chatter.
All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. It's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
That, of course, was Mitt Romney speaking to a $50,000 plate fundraiser back in May, captured surreptitiously by we don't know who, right? We don't know who yet.
We don't.
And we think that Jimmy Carter's grandson helped get the video to Mother Jones.
And that Jimmy Hoffa was somehow involved.
So this video leaked to David Corn of Mother Jones has become the most interesting story or pseudo story of the campaign. Obama supporters quickly pounced on this video, saying it showed Romney was writing off half the population of the country already, that he didn't even understand what he was talking about, given that most of the people who don't pay income taxes are the elderly and our students who either did pay or will pay taxes in their lives, and that it takes some brass for a man who won't even show us his own tax returns to criticize other people for not paying income taxes, and that it reflects the crazy plutocratic extremism of the Republican Party, where a bunch of rich people have hijacked the political system and are fired with resentment against everyone else. Emily, is this video...
Stop calling me Emily.
Is this video a disaster for Romney, or is it an opportunity for him to show genuine policy differences with Obama, or is it just a huge distraction?
He's trying to turn it into an opportunity for real policy differences with this whole idea that Obama is for redistribution and that he is for everyone pulling together and paying their taxes. But, at first I was actually willing to dismiss this whole fracas. I've been trying to follow John's directive not to pay attention to gaffes because they're not supposed to be that revealing. And then on the other hand, this one seems like it kind of is revealing of this basic difference in how Romney and other Republicans see the makers versus the takers in the country. And what struck me as so odd about this is that the whole idea that poor people in particular should not pay taxes is a pretty conservative idea. It's a way of trying to get them to pull themselves up and work more. And so to see that so utterly derided was just odd and dismaying.
John, you are gazing off philosophically into space as though you have grand insights to share.
Yeah. Well, as longtime listeners of this show know, that's constitutionally impossible. But I think – so did you mention – I couldn't catch whether 61% of the people who make up that 47% are people who pay payroll taxes and not income tax. So – and then you have the 22% of that group that are elderly. So as you pointed out, huge chunks of this group that Romney was writing off pay taxes, pay federal taxes, or have at one point in their life, or they're senior citizens. I think the biggest problem with this is kind of counter to what Emily and I had this debate about when Romney said, I don't care about poor people. And my argument was that that an out of context sentence in which you take if you took the context of everything else he was saying, it made more sense. In this case, we have all of the context, and the context is more damning in this case. And what Romney said, what was really interesting to me is I was talking to somebody who is a card-carrying conservative, is going to vote for Mitt Romney, has never voted for a Democrat, really wants Barack Obama out of office. But he said, that video was the first time I felt like I was ever seeing the real Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney has had a problem this entire campaign that people don't feel, even Republicans don't feel like they can actually stick to him, that he is this kind of stainless steel character. And so and that's been one of his issues in terms of connecting with voters who are uncertain about Obama, but also uncertain about him. Does he have something in him that I can make a connection to? And so here you have this moment of apparent authenticity, and it's just the exact wrong one you want if you're trying to appeal to those 4 to 6% of swing voters that Romney also mentioned in that video. And what strikes me about that, or another thing, and we can talk about this, is that everybody said, well, now no politician will ever say anything candid anywhere because they know it's always on film. Well, they probably should have known that it was always going to be recorded anyway. But I think actually that's just the wrong response to this kind of thing by politicians. Because if you closet everything, one of the reasons this is such a big deal with Romney is he's so anodyne in public that any glimpse you get puts you in a situation where any candor makes it seem like it's the truest thing you've ever said and the most true thing about you. And that's a problem.
So do neither of you think it's a winning issue for Republicans to emphasize the takers versus the makers, which is how conservatives are spinning it? That this idea that we have too many people who are just getting government benefits and they're taught to just get government benefits and not enough people who are giving who are contributing to society, is that a way to actually get people energized and motivated? Or is it just going to offend too many other people that it will not be a winner?
I think that it can be made in ways that can galvanize the conservative base, like the welfare to work ad that Romney made that, however false, seemed to me to be a pretty effective way of drumming up that fear that there are all these people who are just getting checks from the government for sitting around. But this was not making that case, really. I mean, this was the idea that half the country, practically everybody you know who gets any kind of government service, is suddenly alien and other and to be condemned. And I just think that goes too far for most people. It's not going to match the lives that they actually lead.
Are the Romney folks going to pursue this, John, or are they going to try to get away from this?
They will try to get away from it by reframing what he said into the larger debate, which has been going on forever, which is about the role of government. So they'll run away from it without trying to look like they are.
All right, let me flip it and put it another way. David Frum had a really great column where look at it from the perspective of the poor, which is the demonization of the poor that seems implicit in what Romney is doing, where he's talking about people who don't pay as being parasites and moochers.
Well, it's explicit.
Right.
Explicit. That's his problem.
And what Frum wrote, I think really eloquently, is this. He wrote, "What makes it all both so heartrending and so outrageous is that all this is occurring at a time when economically disadvantaged Americans have never been so demoralized or passive, never exerted less political clout. No Coxey's army is marching on Washington. No sit-down strikes are paralyzing factory. No squatters are moving on to farmers' fields. The only radical mass movement in this country is the Tea Party, a movement to defend the interests of elderly incumbent beneficiaries of the existing welfare state."
So, David, that's all true. But if you're trying to explain the apprehension that things are otherwise, I mean, you have to take into account symbolism and cultural shifts, right? So we had Occupy Wall Street. It didn't really go anywhere, but it's very useful to kick around if you deride poor people and think they're all these slackers who are just taking. And then I also think that maybe if you're a rich white guy who has a lot of money and has made it, but you don't like other ways in which the country is changing. There are more people who are racial and ethnic minorities. You know, gay people are getting more rights. Maybe that is all bothering you, but it translates into this economic argument, even though really poor people are very downtrodden.
There is a way in which Romney is totally shaped by the forces in the party in a way that George Bush was not in 2000 when he ran. I mean, if you go back and read George Bush's convention speech in the year 2000, he talks about the waitress mom, the woman who probably in some instances, if she had enough kids and didn't make enough money, probably didn't pay federal income tax. He talked about her. He talked about the young kid in juvenile justice hall who raised his hand, a young African-American kid, and said, "Who cares about me?" He talked about immigration. This was a guy you know, as derided as he was, who in 2000 was trying to take the Republican Party to a new place, you know, and there were, and he got a lot of grief from conservatives who were saying, why is he talking about the role of government in people's lives? That seems like another, like, generation ago, and it was just 12 years ago. And this is the discussion that's going on now, even though Romney has yet to win or lose. There's a debate within Republican politics whether some Republican has to step forward and say, our position, the party's position on immigration is dictated by its most conservative members, is wrong, and the party's reflexively anti-government view is politically damaging, because to independent voters or any possible swing voter, it makes it look like we just don't care about a huge portion of the population. And now Mitt Romney has given those incipient fears actual words at length, and that actually damages the party as well.
Let's close with a final question. So even before this video was released by Mother Jones, there was a lot of doomsaying about the campaign. There was talk about the recriminations within the Romney campaign, the sense that it was rudderless or perhaps had the wrong person at the rudder. John, first of all, is the campaign as disorganized as the journalists like to say it is? And second, if it is disorganized, what is the solution? You can't, as Mitt Romney would have come in and fired Mitt Romney as a candidate and replaced Mitt Romney with somebody else, but you can't fire the candidate. So short of firing the candidate, what does this campaign do?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think the campaign has to find a way to connect with that group of voters who are anxious, who have soured on President Obama, but haven't yet found a reason to actually fully abandon him, while at the same time keeping your base as fired up as possible. And those two things are a bit in tension, and depending, you know, on the issue. But that's the best it can do. The problem is the days are drawing short, and it requires a level of execution that we haven't seen yet from the candidate or his campaign.
So, Emily, do you think there's anything that the Romney campaign can do to right itself at this point?
I'm more interested in thinking about if he loses, what should happen next. I mean, it seems like given what John and you were just saying about the extreme positions taking over the party, what should happen is that the explanation given for his defeat would be he pandered so far to the Tea Party and the right, and now we have to bring the ship back into the middle. And, you know, even though Romney was seen as the kind of centrist, milquetoast, moderate candidate, he didn't campaign like one, and that's the direction we have to go in. But on the other hand, it's when things are not that way, when it's the opposite and the Republicans seem so enthralled to their seductive Paul Ryans, it's hard to imagine that happening.
I think you guys, well, you, Emily, are awfully premature in seeing the next thing. I do not think this race is Obama's at all. There are a lot of people who've said it's over. I just think there's a long time and this is a very minor blip. But we'll see. Coming up, will the Supreme Court finally rule on same-sex marriage? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. The Supreme Court returns the first Monday in October, a couple of weeks from now, healthcare in its rearview mirror, and gay marriage barreling down the highway straight at it. The court will need to decide in the next coming days, coming weeks, whether to take any one of the seven, I believe that's right, Emily, seven gay marriage cases that could come before it. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg hinted this week that the court would almost certainly was likely to hear a challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act. So, Emily, what is it that the Supreme Court is weighing? What are the cases at issue? and what's likely to happen?
Well, there's a big choice to be made. There are six cases that are about the Defense of Marriage Act, as you just mentioned. These are the kind of cautious, incremental challenges that the gay rights legal community has spent years getting ready. And there are challenges. These are cases in states where gay marriage is legal, so Massachusetts, Connecticut, states like that. Couples are still not receiving the federal benefits they would get if they were opposite sex couples, so military benefits, pensions. And the reason for that is the Defense of Marriage Act, which for federal purposes defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman. So you can see why this is incremental. This is the idea that if you live in a state that recognizes gay marriage, then the marriage rules should flow from that into the federal domain. It's kind of idea of states determining the definition of marriage, which is traditionally the way marriage law works in this country. So that's pile one. Pile two just has one big fat case in it. It's the California challenge to Proposition 8, the referendum that outlawed gay marriage after the California Supreme Court had instituted it and after thousands of gay couples had actually gotten married in California. That one was brought by David Boies and Ted Olson, who are these kind of superstar pair of lawyers, one from the left and one from the right. And they got together and they put on this really quite amazing trial in which they really showed how little support there is for the proposition that legalizing gay marriage hurts the institution of marriage or could somehow hurt children in any way. That really all fell apart. The problem with that case, though, is that it really rests on this idea that marriage is a fundamental right. And while that is, of course, a dearly held belief in the gay rights community, the notion that the Supreme Court is ready to embrace it and embrace it on behalf of the entire country, most of the states in the country, of course, still don't recognize gay marriage, that's a huge step to ask the court to take. And so most gay rights advocates really want them to take one of the DOMA cases and not Perry versus Hollingsworth, as the California case is called.
And I presume opponents of gay marriage are pushing for the Supreme Court to take the Proposition 8 case and betting that this court, this relatively conservative court, will rule against it.
Exactly. So the people who really stand to gain from Supreme Court review of the California case are the Prop 8 supporters who lost below. So they have this big wind-up where they say that the appeals court ruling that upheld the demise of Prop 8 is tantamount to a judicial death sentence for traditional marriage laws, not just in California, but everywhere in the Ninth Circuit, the federal appeals court, which includes states like Alaska.
Emily, in the wake of all this weird reporting, weird because it so lays bare the conflicts within the court, is there anything going on in the court and its, you know, the Scalia-Roberts fight that changes the environment in which one of these cases could be heard? I mean, it's new territory, right? Because it's there are bruised feelings from the healthcare decision. And I just wonder if that's going to be at play in decisions, particularly in this one.
That's an interesting question. You know, the most important thing about the Supreme Court's decisions to grant review is it only takes four justices to grant review, even though it takes five for a majority. So sometimes four justice majorities can kind of band together for their own reasons, even if they think they're going to lose. And you could imagine Roberts and Scalia and Thomas and Alito kind of reuniting to push for taking the California case because they think that Justice Kennedy will go along with them. On the other hand, you can imagine Justice Kennedy kind of bridling at that and not being so easily manipulated, and the more right-wing judges are realizing that and then kind of stepping back.
In the DOMA cases, Emily, assuming the Supreme Court takes one of these cases and, let's say, throws out DOMA, does that mean anyone who has a gay marriage in a state can then move to any other state and can continue to collect federal benefits? Is that the implication, or would you have to stay in a state that has gay marriage in order to do that?
I think the court would probably issue a relatively narrow ruling that made it clear that only decided the question of the couples that stay in the states like Massachusetts that recognize gay marriage. That separate question you asked, though, has been this really interesting kind of tangled one. Since we started having gay marriage, you know, couples move and then they try to get divorced. And lo and behold, how can they get divorced? Because they're somewhere where it doesn't even recognize they were married to begin with. So those challenges have been actually bubbling up from below. And in some states that don't have gay marriage, they've essentially recognized for the purposes of dissolving a union that they kind of do, which is this interesting kind of legal sleight of hand.
But how could the Supreme Court get rid of the Defense of Marriage Act and not in the same moment established the fact that a marriage is a marriage is a marriage. It's bizarre to say that the marriage exists when you were in Massachusetts, you get certain benefits, but the minute you step over the state line into, you know, Maine, these things vanish.
Right. Well, that's why these are really smart and savvy challenges, because they take a step towards what seems like this inevitable result. However, it all depends on what questions the court decides to review. And so if the question in the Massachusetts case is called Gill, if the question in Gill is, you know, do same-sex couples merit the same federal benefits that opposite-sex couples get in a state with gay marriage, then that will be narrow, and then it will be sort of up to the next set of cases to pose the further question.
And is it your best guess, Emily, that if the Supreme Court takes one of these Defense of Marriage Act cases, that indeed the advocates of gay marriage will win?
I think they pretty much have to win. I mean, the problem is that the case for the harm that gay marriage does, the notion that this is a threat, it's really kind of unraveled at this point. One of the best decisions in this area is this decision in this Massachusetts case, Gill. It's by a, you know, Republican-appointed judge, Michael Boudin. And he's basically saying, look, I don't know whether I'm supposed to, you know, what level of scrutiny I'm supposed to apply to this, because the Supreme Court hasn't said, you know, this is this overall question about whether gay people are the kind of group that get what's called heightened scrutiny, and so laws that discriminate against them are easier to knock off. He said, I'm not sure about that, but you know what? Even under what's the lowest level test, the rational basis test, this law is looking really shaky, and I just don't think that we have enough here to uphold it. And I also think he laid the groundwork for pulling in Justice Kennedy as a fifth vote in these cases.
So when will we hear, Emily, about what cases the court has taken?
The earliest, I mean, we could hear quickly, or it could take them a while to get to this part of the pile, particularly if they're having some argument or tension over which of the cases to grant.
So let's turn to cocktail chatter. When you are at a $50,000 plate fundraising, drinking heavily, what will the hidden cameras record you saying, John Dickerson?
Well, this week, William Shatner, who all of you may know, played Captain Kirk in the Star Trek series, wrote a tweet to Sir Pat Stew, which is Sir Patrick Stewart, who also played a captain on the USS Enterprise in a later version of Star Trek, in which William Shatner said, Sir Pat Stew, I've been trying to get TW Cable LA, that's Time Warner Cable LA, to put CRN Digital Talk Radio back on my service. Been waiting for weeks for answer. Terrible. Then Patrick Stewart responded on Twitter. He said, all I wanted to do was set up a new account with TW Cable NYC. But 36 hours later, I've lost the will to live. So here you have two captains of the Star Trek Enterprise complaining about their cable guy on Twitter. And it just poetry.
Emily Bazelon, what is your chatter?
My chatter is about the New York Times just made an announcement that it is no longer going to allow for after-the-fact quote approval, this practice that is cropping up where politicians and actually also people on Wall Street give interviews, talk. It's supposed to be on the record. And then afterward, they say, you know what? You have to send that back to me for approval. I'm very pleased at the idea of trying to draw a line in the sand about this, because I think the more the more it's allowed, the more people ask for it. And it just drains quotes of any life and makes them just completely useless.
Booyah. My chatter. I read what I think can safely be called one of the most bizarre stories ever written this week. It's by somebody whose name I can't quite pronounce, but I'm going to say it's Maciej Czyglowski. He has a blog called Idle Words, and he gives an account of his girlfriend's battle with cancer. His girlfriend had cervical cancer, and his girlfriend made friends with another young woman with leukemia. These two women became incredibly close. And then something very, 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 very weird happened. Telling you what would happen would ruin the story. But trust me when I say that your jaw will drop when you read this. So check the story out at facebook.com/gabfest. We'll also put a link on the show page. That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political GabFest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington, turning things over to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest Get Thee Behind Me, Satan edition. On today's program, The Master, the new movie from Paul Thomas Anderson. Then Slate's own Hannah Rosen talks about her new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And finally, supersized sodas will now be forbidden in Mayor Bloomberg's New York. Possibly, pending litigation, I'm sure. Joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Dana, why don't I start with you? The Master, of course, is the latest film from Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer-director behind such films as Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and There Will Be Blood. This one stars Philip Seymour Hoffman as a would-be guru modeled somewhat, though this is controversial, on L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, of course, of Scientology. It also stars Joaquin Phoenix as one of the very early followers of this cult. Dana, this is obviously an extraordinary film in one way or another. It's obviously an event. There Will Be Blood, I believe, was a total masterpiece and a triumph. This is his follow-up film. One's response to it cannot possibly be uncomplicated. I'm dying to know what your uncomplicated response to this movie is.
I would say that the first time I saw it, I felt maybe a little bit more aesthetically dazzled, but not so emotionally involved. And it's a pretty complicated story. It's a lot of characters. It's a big palette. It's sort of an epic story, right? It begins during World War II and ends maybe midway through the 50s or so. So it covers a pretty big, expansive time. But the relationship that it centers on, which is this relationship between the guru, the master, as he's called in the film, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, and Freddie Quill, who's the World War II veteran that Joaquin Phoenix plays, is really the emotional heart of the movie. And I think the reason that it's a little bit hard to know where you stand in relation to sort of who to identify with or who to care about in this movie is that they're both so opaque and mysterious, right? It's kind of like this clashing of wills, as was There Will Be Blood, right, between an older man and a younger man. And even more so than in There Will Be Blood, I would say, these two characters are sort of these mythic, unknowable walls that you just can't get past a certain point. And that, to me, made it hard, at least on a first viewing, to know exactly where to place yourself as a viewer. Let's listen to a clip from the movie.
You seem so familiar to me.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
Julia, it seems to me there's no way to encounter this movie without talking about and thinking about the performances, which are remarkable, right? I mean, there is every bit as astonishing, really, as the cinematography of the look of the film. What did you think about seeing these two really masterful American actors interacting with one another as these archetypal characters, the master and his would-be slave, in a way?
I basically thought that Joaquin Phoenix was outmatched. I think that Philip Seymour Hoffman gave an extraordinary performance, one of the best I can remember of his, as this puffed-up, pompous man who has started this cult and built this community and has his own insecurities and flies off the handle. But you can also see why he's charming and how he's cultivated this group of followers. And I found the Freddie Quill character, as played by Joaquin Phoenix, to be this inscrutable bundle of ticks. And I felt like for the narrative of the story, I mean, to me, the story is about what is it that makes people drawn into cults? What is it? What is the appeal of a group like this or a leader like this? And Freddie is such an inscrutable character and such an unrelatable character that I don't feel like the movie actually really helps you understand what would bring someone in.
I have to say, I really disagree with you. I thought of this as a film very much about the spiritual slave. Like, what is it about someone that draws them into the fold and allows them to eventually give themselves their own volition, their own sense of purpose and spiritual being over to someone else that endows someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman with the powers of a master? That seems to me the real mystery. The movie opens with Joaquin Phoenix and really follows him. And one of the Dana, I wonder if you agree with me, one of the more remarkable scenes in a recent American movie is the one where they finally meet, which is on a boat, and boats play a huge role, symbolic role in this movie. And it conveys to you the feeling of what it is to be a totally contextless, abandoned human being. He's suffering from war trauma. He has no social context within which to re-experience himself as a normal human being, and he's effectively drifting. And he comes across this boat that's kind of lit magically from within. It's just lambent and floating universe. And he enters that world, and you enter that world with him from his point of view.
After having, we should say, spent about 20 minutes following him through all sorts of peripatetic, horrible post-war time adventures where he can't hold down a job. He suddenly has outbursts of violence at every job and has to leave. He's on the run from some migrant workers that are trying to kill him. So essentially at that point, we've come a long way with Freddie Quill and seen how lost he is.
And then you experience what it is to go from a life with no center of gravity whatsoever to one in which a kind of family, a self-created family, coheres around one enormously powerful, charismatic human being. And all of a sudden, this thing that's accompanied all of us all our lives, the cults of the 1970s, Scientology, for which this is meant to be a kind of account of, ambiguously an account of, suddenly they make a kind of sense in a way. And I thought Phoenix really delivered a masterful method performance of a man whose body has really physically been reshaped by loneliness and war trauma and what this experience might mean to him. I thought he was the center of the movie.
That he's the center of the movie, I don't dispute. I see Julia's discomfort with the two different registers that they're performing in, and I think that was probably deliberate, but I don't think there was anything that Paul Thomas Anderson could probably have done about it. It seems to me like he gave both of those actors kind of the free rein to do what they were going to do, and Joaquin Phoenix went very far down this sort of Brando-esque road, right, of just kind of feral being.
Right. I mean, he's definitely the heart of the story, and I think that's why I found the performance a bit of a barrier to entering the world of the movie as completely as I think I could have if someone had given a slightly more subdued but equally pathos-filled performance. I mean, what did you guys make of this? This was touted in the run-up to the film as Paul Thomas Anderson's expose of Scientology, you know, is finally the movie about L. Ron Hubbard. What did you think, and what do you think viewers will think of that if they go into the movie with those expectations?
You know, especially given, if you remember in Magnolia, the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia, who was not exactly a cult leader, but who was a sort of a very scary motivational speaker, right? I thought that this movie was going to be more along those lines, that there'd be some sort of an incendiary critique of kind of brainwashing and cultism. And it's actually not terribly critical of these post-war spiritual movements, of which Scientology was one, as I thought it would be at all. In fact, there's really a lot of understanding afforded toward, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and his attempt to recreate some kind of a community in this post-war vacuum.
Yeah, it's a deeply sympathetic movie without an ounce of apology, right, which is an extraordinary needle to have threaded. We can all agree, right, you'd be crazy to skip this movie. People should go see it, right? This is just a, you know, to put it crudely, this is just a massive three-way thumbs up from us, right?
Yes, I think people should see it. I mean, I didn't like it as much as There Will Be Blood. I felt it was a little slower. There were some barriers to entry, but it's just so beautiful. I mean, for the single shot that repeats actually three or four times in the movie of the wake of a boat, which for anyone who's ever ridden ferries or just been on boats, looking at the wake of a boat in water as it unfurls behind you is one of the most glorious things that can happen to you in your life as a human on the planet. And I've never really seen it captured on film. And they're just these long shots of wakes in the movie. Just go for the wakes. That's my review.
Agreed.
I also think we should shout out the music, which I think, as always, Paul Thomas Anderson is great at choosing music. He's great at choosing pop standards, in this case, old World War II kind of jazz standards. And for example, I absolutely love the montage early in the film when we're seeing Joaquin Phoenix settle into his post-war life not very comfortably. And on the soundtrack, we hear Ella Fitzgerald singing Get Thee Behind Me, Satan, which at that moment is so multivalent. It means that he's putting the war behind him, right? But it also has to do with sexual temptation and this woman that he has his eye on in the department store where he works. I thought that was a beautiful musical moment. The original score by Johnny Greenwood, the Radiohead guitarist who also did the There Will Be Blood score, is just astounding. Very unsettling, weird, atonal, sort of keeps you permanently off balance throughout the film.
Coming up, The End of Men. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. All right, well, for our next segment, we're joined by Hannah Rosen. Hannah is a writer for The Atlantic and co-founder of the Double X section of Slate magazine. Her new book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, before we dig in, one thing. Are you the specific woman who will make David Plotz obsolete?
Absolutely. Did you see what the Today Show wrote when they introduced him? They had his main title as Hannah Rosen's husband. At that point, I felt like a little bad. That was a little much.
That was kind of great. We were passing that JPEG around Slate.
I think that's a signal achievement. All this is a way of saying that you are, in fact, the wife of the editor-in-chief of Slate magazine, purposes of full disclosure. But anyway, diving right in, first of all, mazel tov on what appears to be the enormous success of the book. It has the almost unique virtue of being built around a soundbite, which makes it very sellable, but built its own stuff that it's built out of is actual argumentative subtlety, statistics, numbers, examples, reporting, and very good humor and insight. There are many handles to this book, so the mystery is sort of where to start with it. Why don't you start by telling us what is it about the economy now and what structural changes is it going through that allows women to thrive in a way that men cannot?
Well, it starts a few decades ago with the, you know, demise of the manufacturing era. So that's the most literal interpretation, that it used to be quite easy to be a guy and have some degree of training and have a pretty prosperous middle class life, like some of the men who I describe in the book. And that era largely passed, and then it was hard for people to adjust. Like, guys don't like to go to school right now. It seems that you need some degree of training and education for every job, which really didn't used to be true, and it's probably not that great. It's just the moment that we're in now, and women are better at that. I mean, they've been better at getting education probably for a century. Like in 1902, when the high school movement started, teenage girls got more high school degrees than teenage boys. It just didn't matter so much. Like until the 20s, there wasn't that much opportunity, so it wasn't that great. If it was 1905 and you were really good at school, it didn't really matter all that much.
So what are the sectors of the economy that women are moving into, and why are they doing so much better, do you think, than men in this economy?
Yeah, so better is a funny word, because sometimes it's because women are willing to start at the bottom, which you can see from some of my characters. So you see, like, you have income differentials. It's just men don't, you know, when men have been on top, they don't want to start at the bottom. So you have, like, the service economy is one obvious thing. It's this funny thing where women at the top enter the workforce and they stop doing the things that women used to do for free, like childcare, food preparation, elder care. And so you have this huge growing jobs in those categories that were, you know, that were once free women's work. So that's part of the dynamic that's happening. And then just the creative economy, which we all work in and which is fairly complicated, and which we could at least say doesn't favor men in the way things used to favor men. That doesn't mean at the very top, like, it doesn't favor men, but in general, in a broad spectrum, you know, there's no particular advantage a man has over a woman for a large number of creative jobs. I mean, really, the one place that's growing where men have an advantage is technology.
Hannah, about the top, it seems like the main critique of your book, from what I see in all the media appearances you've been doing lately, the place that people always want to come in and give you flack has to do with at the very top of finance, of tech, of politics, of various industries. You still find a preponderance of men and not women. And I wanted to hear your answer to that.
Yeah, that is a really hard one. I mean, the when I got to that point in my reporting, and I have a chapter called The Top, what hit me full in the face is that we are obviously still uncomfortable with women in power and women in a certain kind of dominant aggressive power, like that deep in some psyche, we're trying to work out how we feel about women at the very top. And, you know, like all the psychological research I cite in the book shows that women get punished for behaving in certain ways that mimic male power. Like, women always get punished for that in psychological studies.
Well, and hopefully that last step in that evolution would be removing aggression and dominance as prerequisites from being a leader, right? I mean,
I'm mixed on that question, because it's definitely true so far that women lead slightly differently. But like, my violence chapter is obviously the weirdest chapter in the book. It's a book I describe changing violence patterns and how women are enacting certain kinds of public behavior and aggressive violent behavior that they didn't used to. And I put that in there because I haven't finished working out this question yet. Like, I did not want to land in the Steven Pinker zone that, like, you know, what is it Steven Pinker says? Like, if the world were run by breastfeeding mothers, the world would be a better place. Like, I don't feel that in my bones. And so I think that women make decisions differently. Like, they have a little more long-term thinking. And they're a little more collaborative generally, like they tend to take other views into account right now. But I don't think they're nicer exactly. So I don't know. Do you guys have opinions on that? Do you instinctively feel like the world would be a better place, even if it were run by women? I just can't decide.
Well, I live entirely in a world run by women and love it. So
we made
him is it
that.
A nice place?
It is paradise, let me tell
yes.
you.
I mean, that's the thing that was interesting to me about your larger argument, Hannah, is that in some ways – it sounds like this is good news for women. They're gaining more autonomy. They're gaining more freedom from domestic violence and rape. They're, you know, finally succeeding in the economy in a way that they haven't in the past. But for the larger American story, it sort of seems like bad news. It's basically the good jobs for which you did not need that much training, but you got a lot of money and stability and benefits have gone away. And women, because they have less experience in the workforce and less expectation or entitlement to a job like the one I've just described, are willing to rush into the gap and take crappier, cruddier jobs. And it seems like maybe the model you're suggesting is that perhaps men should be more flexible and also take these cruddy, crappy jobs. But won't that leave us with a country where everybody has cruddier, crappier subsistence-level jobs and no benefits, and it makes it harder for families to succeed?
So culturally, I feel not that ambivalent about where men are moving. Like culturally, I feel like it would do men good to, you know, if it were acceptable for your wife to make more money than you did and there was no problem with that and that was fine for everybody and you could stay home for some periods and nobody would judge you any differently. Like that would be a good world to live in and that would be better for a lot of people. But economically, I'm really ambivalent. I mean, I leave this town in Alabama, like the one I wrote about that was my excerpt in the Times Magazine piece, and I feel extremely protectionist. I think like, damn, why did we – what they need is a factory, you know? Like, all they need is for us to put back that – like, why did we move the factory down to Latin America so we could have, you know, toilet paper that was 20 cents cheaper? I mean, I understand there's a more sophisticated global argument here, but that's how I feel, yes. I feel like it should be fine for people not to have to get a college degree and have a totally – decent, prosperous, middle-class existence. I also made a mistake because the guy in my introduction ends up going to nursing school at the end, and that pisses people off. Like, is that really what we all have to do is all become women, you know? Mm. Which is a legitimate question, actually.
Why are nurses women? That's another whole question. That's
I don't know. Right. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that nurses have to be women, but it's one of those things
where we should all become nurses.
Exactly. We should all become nurses. Men, like, really, really resist going into professions that are female-dominated. That's been true for the last century, and whereas women don't have that ambivalence at all. And, you know, I'm not sure. You see it in profession after profession where women rush in and men flee.
Well, Hannah, did you find in your research that there's a part of women that want men to be the breadwinner and don't want them to leave that protectorate position that we're used to thinking of men as occupying?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely came across couples who I interviewed who are in the book who have a who are nostalgic, women who really don't want to be the breadwinner, who would like things to go back to the way they were. But rather than externalize it, somebody asked me the other day, well, how would you feel if your husband became a full-time stay-at-home dad? You know, what are you really asking? Isn't it women who are putting men in this fairly narrow protector position? So you actually have to think about, like, are you actually saying that men should just all become feminized and that would be fine? And so I really had to think about that a lot because I think there must be some place where we all draw the line, you know, some visceral place. Now, my answer was not like I would be disgusted if my husband became a stay-at-home dad. I definitely would not be disgusted. I was thinking more like, what if he really liked it? I mean, I don't think of it that all that differently than how I think of stay-at-home moms, you know, like if he was really into it and he, you know, was really he wasn't like more, you know, depressed and, you know, he seemed to be like enjoying. I don't know. What do you guys have a view on that? Like, what if either of your husbands became stay-at-home dads? Would that be okay with you?
I feel like my life's goal is to make enough money that can happen.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at you, Julia.
I mean, I feel like I'd be okay with it, too. I mean, one thing you describe really well in the book is this concept of the seesaw marriage and that for the group of people in America who are college-educated, what we're seeing is a rise of an egalitarian marriage where people shift roles and sometimes one half of the couple is the breadwinner and sometimes it's the other half and they flip around. So it does not boggle my notions of masculinity or my place in the world as a woman to think about various possible ways in which we could configure our household in the future.
That's great. I've previously only heard that full-throated an endorsement from people who write me from Portland. So now I feel
maybe that's where
I could add Brooklyn to Portland, and at least I have two places where people are totally okay with it.
All right. Well, Hannah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, finally, the New York Board of Health has approved a ban of large sodas in New York City. Of course, this was masterminded by the mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, as a way of combating, Julia, obesity, which is epidemic in our country right now. Julia, it seems to me we'll get to the subtleties of the research and the nuances of policy in a minute, but one's first reaction to this, I think, tends to be instinctive and emotional, right? And the obvious breakdown are those people who immediately say, good Lord, this is nanny state overreach of the worst kind. And then those other people who say, this is just of a piece with forcing people to wear seatbelts and banning smoking in public places. I'm curious, what was your first reaction to this?
I'm a fan of the smoking ban, but I have a bit of a, like, get off my back, Mayor Bloomberg response to this as my gut level. Don't get between me and my 32-ounce soda, although I haven't drunk a 32-ounce soda in, like, at least 10 years, if ever. So, yes, I have a bit of a knee-jerk negative response to it. What about you, Dana?
I think I feel kind of the opposite. After doing all this reading and going back and forth and reading about the science, I'm just exactly the same as I was at the beginning, which is just like, I'm fine with it. If you want 32 ounces of soda, you can still buy two 16-ounce sodas in New York. I guess in a way that amounts to a tax because it would cost marginally more than buying the 32-ounce soda. But I don't know. I did not like when Mike Bloomberg got himself a third term. That was a moment that I thought I was never going to like anything he did again. But I'm fine with all his nanny statism. I think he's a benevolent dictator, and it'll be an interesting experiment. If it reduces obesity rates, then at least we know something. We've been a guinea pig.
Right. I mean, there's so many different questions all bound up in, you know, what this ultimately means. The first is one of classification, right? How do you classify drinking that amount of soda? Is it more like smoking a cigarette? Who's the victim of it? And then, as Mark Bittman pointed out in the New York Times, he said, look, your right to harm yourself, the kind of libertarian, blanket libertarian idea that we can all do whatever we want so long as it's the only victim is ourselves, you know, that ends where the harm that you commit to yourself becomes a harm committed to me. And on the verge of Obamacare, we have to start to think about what the social costs of obesity are. To what degree are they externalized beyond the individual consumer of the soda? And then the second is, well, what is the state of the science, which Dan Engber, a science columnist for Slate, has written about quite intriguingly, right? That what makes a soda different is liquids can be consumed in vastly greater caloric quantities than solid foods, because solid foods will actually trigger your desire to stop consuming. They'll provide you with satiety in a way that sugary drinks won't. And then the question is, well, is there something specifically awful about refined sugar? On one end of the popular journalism spectrum is Mark Bittman, who insists that in 2050, you pick the increment of time, years hence, we're going to look back on refined sugar the way we now look back on tobacco, as something that is an absolute self-inflicted pox that had to be done away with and would be done away with eventually. So, Julia, I add it all up, and I guess I'm in favor of it, but so equivocally that I don't know that I could survive an argument with a committed, angry libertarian who hated it.
Well, I think one of the issues, which Dan pointed out in his piece, is that the science on this isn't super conclusive. I mean, the idea, you know, is it really going to affect the obesity rates in New York to ban this particular type of soda in this particular type of establishment while making no effort to limit the purchase of massive quantities of soda in bodegas or newsstands around the city or street carts? You know, is that really going to have an effect on where people are making these purchases, on what they're doing? There hasn't been a lot of sociological research on that. And then in terms of the base science research, I mean, that point about drinks and whether they make you full and the ability to consume more calories through liquid than through solids, it's a little inconclusive. And there have been meta-studies and meta-meta-studies, and nobody can quite settle on what the science is at this point. And it's unclear whether that's because some of those studies have been funded by or conducted by folks with associations with the soda industry, or because there actually is uncertainty there. So I do think it just feels so narrow to me. I mean, if we really think sugar is an evil and soda is a bad thing, let's have a broader soda tax, or let's either, I guess I'm for more consistency of action. Like, let's either take a bolder stand or just let people drink what they want to drink.
We should say that he attempted to go the tax route, and that was a total non-starter with a legislature in Albany. But Dana, okay, so I have this angry libertarian in my head who's arguing with me all the time, and I hate letting him win, but I'm afraid I'm being cowed into silence on this issue. And then I read this from Bittman, who I think has been very astute on this. He says, right now, as we speak, a tall 5-year-old with a dollar can approach a vending machine and buy a fizzy beverage equivalent to a cup of coffee with 9 teaspoons of sugar in it, and that's a mere 12 ounces. You can call it the nanny state as much as you want. Certain behaviors require a nanny to rein them in. Don't you think this is one of them?
Yeah, you're preaching to the converted. Bring on Mary Poppins state. Bring it on. I mean, seriously, honestly, this is an answer to your inner libertarian. If Mike Bloomberg isn't deciding how much soda you're going to drink, you know who's deciding it? The beverage industry, right? I mean, they're the reason that sizes have gone up from, what, 6 ounces that Cokes used to be back in the 50s to 32 ounces now. And there's corn subsidies. The government is subsidizing it. There's so many disgusting things about the beverage industry that is sponsoring some of these studies. Now I'm sounding like Steve Metcalf on some sort of paranoid nut rant.
But there's substance to that rant, which makes you very unlike me. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
I am going to endorse a specific aspect of Pandora, the music listening service online, that I was discussing at the retreat, actually, with Forrest Wickman, our erstwhile intern and now an editor at Slate. I was asking him if he ever reads Pandora. We were talking about fine-tuning your Pandora channel and how much fun it is to have various Pandora channels with different levels of sort of, you know, breadth and genres. And then I was just mentioning to him that the write-ups on Pandora are fantastic. And I was wondering if you guys ever read them. If you you find yourself drifting through Pandora and you think, I've never heard of this artist, click on the name or the album art will take you there too, I believe. And there's these beautifully written, very condensed, just little gems of kind of, I wouldn't call it music criticism, but music history, something like that.
Dana, I just have to pop in here really quickly. I think they have a deal with allmusic.com, which is, and that's where the text comes from. And the writing is terrific. It's a remarkable resource.
Exactly. So that's my endorsement, is next time you're on Pandora, just fall down the Pandora K-hole. I did not realize all music was involved, but kudos to them.
All right, Julia, what do you got?
So this week I finally got around to watching Firefly, which is the sad, lost series of Joss Whedon. It is a space western that only existed for 15 episodes at some point in the early aughts, I think, and then was canceled, and then they made a movie, Serenity, to wrap up the storylines, and basically, it's regarded as a lost Joss classic by his devotees, and I count myself as a devotee, but I'd never actually bothered to sit down and watch it. And if you're in my boat of liking Joss but not already being up to speed on all of his things, I would recommend this. For one thing, unlike finally deciding to get through The Sopranos or The Wire or any other series that you've heard is great but haven't started to watch, there's only 15 episodes, and it just has great characters, a great setting. The world it envisages is fascinating and marvelous, and sort of the frontiers of a post-apocalyptic space universe. And it's fun.
Cool. I'll check it out. All right. So very briefly, are they New Zealand band A-ha?
New Zealand or Australia? Go to allmusic.com, Steve.
Oh, here I go.
It's Norwegian.
A-ha?
Okay, well, it turns out they're Norwegian, and so we all know Take On Me, but they had a wonderful song called Manhattan Skyline, and one of my favorite pop acts of the last few years is a Norwegian folk duo called Kings of Convenience, and they covered one of the slightly lesser well-known songs of A-ha called Manhattan Skyline, and it's just an utterly fragile, beautiful, Nick Drake-like take on that song. But I noticed they came out in 2001, and one of the things that I find quite moving about the song is that, you know, I think we all looked for ways to memorialize the loss that we collectively felt in the face of 9/11, but without an ounce of jingoism. And one thing I think that recurs to people is just that absence in the Manhattan skyline. And I think that's why they recorded the song, though I'm not sure, because it came out in 01, and I'm not sure whether it came out in October or November of 2001, but certainly that is the evocation that that song brings with it. It's an utterly beautiful way to think about those events. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest, and you'll find the longer podcast version of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Vuolo and Chris Wade. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.
So I read to myself a chance of a lifetime to see new horizons. On the front page, a black and white picture of Manhattan skyline.